Tonight, we're going to finish up the book of Amos. We started the book some before the days of unleavened bread and said we'd come back to it. So we're going to do that this evening. So as you well know, Amos is one of the minor prophets. And since what we're doing is a survey, we're not going to go through Amos verse by verse. We're going to pick out particular verses that are especially pertinent and prove helpful. So just to recap from what we've gone through in the previous study, we had in part one, we went through the history and geographical details about the book of Amos. And we also noted several prophetic portions of the book that are, and the gist of it was pretty heavy. I mean, when you look at what Amos has to say, it is pretty daunting. And I think that will be the case this evening as we can continue through the book and seek to finish it this evening. So to set the stage, I'd like to quote from the end of the last study we went through on this book. And as I said in that study, there's a quote from the end of it. I said, you know, when we look at the Bible, Israel between David and the end of his reign had days of glory. The big threats were the Egyptians to the south, the Assyrians to the northeast, and even later, after the fall of the Assyrian Empire, the Babylonian Empire. But but there was a period of time in which David lived, in which they were not threatened by their neighbors. And as a result of that, they were able to prosper. So whenever Israel was not negatively impacted by their neighbors and dominated by their neighbors, which happened, you know, as the Assyrians took control or the Moabites or the other peoples around them took control, then they were dominated by them. And one of the big challenges that they faced was they did not control the trade routes. And the trade routes were essential to their prosperity. And when they controlled the trade routes, they tended to be quite well-to-do and quite prosperous. But they didn't always do that. And they did not have that control because there were times when God was not blessing them. As you think about this, after the fall of Assyria, there was a power vacuum. And that's what happens. A nation falls who's been the controlling power. And when they fall, then other nations can do what they want to do. They're not restricted anymore. So they can venture beyond the bounds that they're used to. And so that's what was happening when Assyria fell. Assyria was completely engaged in a life and death struggle with Armenia. And so the Armenians were apparently rather powerful, and the Assyrians couldn't control them and couldn't conquer them. So it took a while for that to sort out. The nation of Syria, which had given Israel so much trouble during Ahab's time and Jehu's time, that nation had fallen. They had been conquered, and during the time of Jeroboam II and an earlier king, which allowed them to prosper, a place called Hamath, which is not in Israel but up in Syria, was conquered, and they were able to extend their borders all the way up toward the Euphrates River. So they had basically control from south near Egypt all the way up into Syria to toward the Euphrates River. They had a lot of power and influence, and that was allowed them to be able to prosper. So what we see is that the borders of the kingdom were reestablished, and the kings that they had were aggressive, and they were able to conquer other nations and enter into treaties with them, which allowed them to prosper. They subjugated Moab and Ammon. And basically, in the time when Amos was a prophet, Israel was a rich, powerful, and safe. And into that environment, Amos comes, and he speaks to them and addresses their internal problems, because they did have some serious internal problems, which we'll look at as we go through this. We talked about the dating of Amos, when it most probably was prophecy was given in the time frame of the kings that are mentioned. And so we won't go through that again. Now, just one principle to keep in mind before we start is the principle of duality. And duality is something that you find in prophecy. You find that as a prophecy is given, it applies in the time in which it is given. But many times the prophecy is not fulfilled in its fullness, but that will take place in the future, many times in the end time. For instance, you look at many prophecies in Isaiah, and it speaks of Isaiah's own time when the prophecy would be fulfilled. But you also can look down the road and you can see that this prophecy is going to be fulfilled more toward the end of the age as well. So as you think about it, just as an example, you look at Solomon and you look at David and look at what was prophesied about him. As you look at the future, a descendant of David is going to come into prominence. You know, we know him as the Christ. And so you have these prophecies that apply to David, but you also have prophecies that are going to unfold with the coming of Jesus Christ. Duality in prophecy is important to keep in mind. As you look at the book of Isaiah, as I said, you'll see this one thing mentioned in the chapter, and then it's moving on, and it'll continue talking about the same thing, but in a completely different context, which you have to pay attention to in order to understand what's being spoken about. So as you look at Israel during the time we're talking about, during the time in which Amos prophesied, Israel as a nation had rebounded. Israel had basically was not influential or powerful, but God allowed them to rebound and to surge in power once again. And so as we're looking through this, Israel was riding a crest of prosperity. And so as you look at Amos, it is interesting because it has a focus, and it's not just on Israel's disrespect for God and betrayal of God and worshiping false gods. That's in the book of Amos. But the book of Amos talks about something that's very different than that, and it has to do with Israel not applying the principles of loving their fellow man that God had given them. God told them that they were not to mistreat their brother. They were to remember that they had come out of the land of Egypt, and they had suffered being slaves in Egypt, and therefore they were to keep in mind their experience, which they didn't like, and seek to treat their brother properly. And God gave them principles in his law that governed how you treat your neighbor. And unfortunately, Israel rejected those ideas and those applications. And unfortunately, we can see some input here that shows that they were not living up to what God wanted them to do at all. So as you look at Amos's approach, he's reprimanding the people for their lack of respect for one another. And as you think about what we talked about at Passover time, You look at what was taking place in the Corinthian church. They did not love each other. They didn't understand the concept. And yet they're taking the Passover and on the very night of Passover mistreating each other because they did not understand the concepts of loving your neighbor and basically being your brother's keeper. They did not understand that for whatever reason, and most assuredly didn't apply it. As you look at just a summary of what Amos emphasizes is that God brought them out of Egypt and he gave them a benevolent set of laws in terms of how they were to treat each other. So, you know, if you had a brother who was in debt, how are you to treat him? Were you to treat him as a slave? Well, the Bible does not allow you to do that, but that's exactly what they were doing. They were mistreating their brothers and sisters and very, very sharp in their practices, as we'll see. So basically, because they were not following what God instructed them to do in regard to how they treated each other, they were not a light to the world. And God allowed this for a while and eventually said, okay, enough of this. And as we'll see, he brings it to a halt. So Amos is an interesting book in that regard, as it points out this man's inhumanity to man and repeatedly brings it out. And God worshiping other gods is a secondary issue in this particular book. So as you look at what it says in Amos, and you compare it to our country today, go back maybe about 50 years. I know we were talking about the good old days before we started this evening, but if you go back in that time, life was much different back then. You know, as you look at people before the war, many of them had to go through the Great Depression. Life was hard. The food was scarce. Jobs were scarce. People didn't have a lot of money. And so then to a certain extent, what people went through at that time during the Depression and the hardships they went through in actuality, in one way, helped them to weather the storm of World War II, where they had to go through doing without. They had to be willing to do without in order to make sacrifices for the war effort. So they had gone through certain things. And then when the war ended, then basically, if you looked at the world, the only country left standing was the United States. So the United States was in a position to be great among the nations because there was nobody else. So it was the United States who contributed to Europe coming back from the brink. I mean, they didn't have food. Life was pretty tough there. Things had been bombed out, the same for Japan. And so the United States was able to help these nations and help them get back on their feet. And really, the United States could have dominated all of these other nations, but that was not the approach that we took. Was it that we never took advantage? We did, I'm sure. But the overall approach was one of helping these nations and helping them through the struggles that they're going through. And so the United States has been the dominant nation in the world. There came a point when England basically said, we're done. We're done with the empire. We're not going to intervene in all of the issues that come up in the world. And basically they said, U.S., you take over. And the U.S. filled that vacuum. So we filled that vacuum for quite some time, but things are changing. The world in which we live is changing. And where we've been a powerful and influential nation in the world, you can see that's not the case anymore. Yes, we are rich. Yes, we do have power, but it's not like it once was. and nations are seeking to come out from under our influence. And I just would cite a couple of things here. As you look at what's taking place, we're on the brink of a new world order where the descendants of Israel are no longer going to be supreme. One writer by the name of Andrew Roberts wrote about the history of the American people, people of Israel and their descendants. And it was interesting that he mentioned how the United States and Britain dominated the world, but he said that's coming to a close. And this was said a number of years ago. And so people have not liked America. They've not liked the British Empire. So they've reveled in the fact that they've fallen. But the thing that you have to realize is, yes, they were flawed. But when you look at what's coming to replace them, then that's going to be a much different situation. One writer was talking about this, and he said, Europe, Russia, India, and China are all trying to vying for the dominant role in the world. For example, this fellow wrote an article about de-dollarization. And he said, de-dollarization isn't a fairy tale, it's a goal. So de-dollarization means that the dollar is no longer going to be the standard currency used for the exchange of goods and services. So they're going to replace it with whatever they can set up as the supreme currency in the world. And various nations are contending for that. The Chinese, the Russians, they're all contending to take that role, because when your money is the dominant money, then it gives you certain benefits that we've enjoyed for a long time. But when that goes away, then all of those blessings go away with it. And you basically are, sadly, you are based in trouble, and you're going to pay more for things, and you're not going to have control like we once did. In the article, it says, most Western economists dismiss de-dollarization out of hand. They just don't believe it can happen. It'll never happen. Well, there were people that said the pound would all, and the sterling would always be dominant. Well, is it dominant today? No, it's not. So that prediction did not last. And the United States being dominant is not going to last either. These economists said that the rest of the world can't decouple from the U.S. dollar for many reasons, they say. And there are reasons. But then things change in the world, which allow this to go forward. Also, it was said in the article, but we're not talking about passive moves. I don't know whether you know who the BRICS are. The BRICS are nations that are trying to de-dollarize and establish their own coalitions in order to be more independent of dominance by Europe, and especially by the United States. The BRICS are Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa. I don't know, it's mentioned in there. I'm not sure how South Africa got in there. They're aggressively trying to de-dollarize and that makes all the difference. So we are, as a nation, we are still relatively prosperous, and we're comfortable. Most of us probably are comfortable this evening. You know, if it's too hot, too warm in your home, you can turn on your AC. You can control all of those things at this time. We're comfortable with our washers and dryers and dishwashers and all of those things. And those are blessings. But will those things, you know, when you turn on the lights, they actually come on? Is that going to be something that continues? Especially with the ideas of doing away with fossil fuels and all of that power production. We have a few members of our society, interestingly, in the time in which we live, who are fabulously wealthy. and they basically have become the elite. And they are the ones that are seeking to gain power and gain control over everything. You know, you have these meetings at Davos. Well, Davos and all of those people coming together there are not working for America. Their goal is to set up a government that is independent of all these other governments and is going to operate like they, as the smartest people in the world, can conceive of it. And that's not always going to be in our best interest. So what's taking place here is a little bit scary, because we don't know how it's going to work out. It may stay the same for a while, but we can see that things are bound to change. As you look at God and the book of Amos, God's greatest anger in the book of Amos is not centered on how people worship him. That's not his focus in the book of Amos. That is a focus, but not his central focus. But how people violate the humanitarian laws that God gave Israel in the wilderness. Basically, you could summarize it as man's inhumanity to man. Thereby disrespecting not only their fellow man, but the one who gave the laws in the first place. And when I was thinking about this, I remembered back to when I was at Ambassador College and was taking a class on ancient Israel. And one of the books that we went through that I didn't spend much time in while I was in school, but after I got out of school, I went back and read through the book. It's a book called The History of Israel by John Bright. So it's a 70s vintage book, but what it has to say is interesting. And I think you'll be able to understand more about the book of Amos when I read the little section that I thought was pertinent to tonight. John Bright says in his book, it is certain, however, that the lot of the humbler citizens was unnecessarily hard and that the state did little or nothing to alleviate it. So the state was all it was worried about the state. The state was not worried about the common man. They were worried about the elites and basically served them. And they didn't worry about those people who were just regular part of the system, the regular citizens. Israelite society, as Amos lets us see, it was marked by egregious injustices and a shocking contrast between the extremes of wealth and poverty. The small farmer whose economic status was marginal at best found himself often at the mercy of the moneylender. And at the slightest calamity, a drought, a crop failure, liable to foreclosure and eviction, if not bond service. So when you hear the term moneylender, that is not a good thing. A moneylender is going to lend you money at exorbitant rates. And if you don't pay them, you know, they call them long shots, long sharks as well. And they are people who have money to lend and they lend the money, but there's a short time that they're going to lend it to you. And the expectation is you're going to pay it at the end of that short time. And if not, they're going to apply exorbitant rates to you. And if you don't pay them, then there's a very heavy price to be paid. And this was something that was going on in Israel. As John Bright continues, the system, which was itself harsh, was made harsher by the greed of the wealthy, who took unmerciful advantage of the plight of the poor in order to enlarge their holdings, often resorting to the sharpest practices, the falsification of weights and measures, with various legal dodges to achieve their ends. But though dishonest practices obtained or took place everywhere, since the judges were also in it for the money, they had been bought off, they were going to decide as the people paying them wanted them to. So they were not going to exercise justice. The poor had no redress. in increasing numbers. They were robbed and dispossessed. And it's a sad commentary on the nation of Israel at that particular time. They were wealthy. They had great wealth. They were enjoying great prosperity, but they didn't care that not everybody enjoyed that wealth and that prosperity. And if it meant that you would lose your farm and they could take over your farm, they were glad to do it and put you out on the street. It's always amazed me if you go back in the time of the 15, 1600s, 1700s, it's interesting if somebody couldn't pay their debt, they put them into debtor prison. Now, that doesn't make a bit of sense, because if you couldn't pay it before you went to prison, how did you pay it when you couldn't earn a living? But that was the thinking back in that particular time. So people were in the debtor prison, and it was a very hard place to be. And how you got out of there, somebody may have paid your debt, but it was a hard living. And it makes me think of, as you look at what was taking place at that time, and I think you can see it unfolding in our time. It makes me think of what Christ said in Matthew chapter 24, verse 12. And this is a familiar scripture, but I think it is very applicable to the time in which we live. It says, "And because lawlessness will abound." Just think about it for a minute. Does lawlessness abound? And if we had time to talk about it, I could cite multiple examples of lawless things that are taking place in our society. They've become commonplace. And I'm just talking about economic things. I'm not talking about all the other crazy things going on that indicate lawlessness. But lawlessness will abound, which I think it does in our time. And the love of many will wax cold. That's where you have reached the point where you're living in luxury, and all you care about is your luxury, your prosperity, and you could care less about your neighbor. And that's not everybody in our society, but unfortunately, I think as time is going along, our society is becoming more callous, more hardened in some of the things that are going on. So let's get into the book. Let's get into the book, into Amos chapter 1 and 2. And those two chapters follow a particular pattern that you find in those two chapters, which I'll cite here. And basically, there's a phrase here that's used with several different nations. And it goes this way in verse 3, chapter 1, verse 3. It says, "Thus says the Lord, for three transgressions of Damascus and for four, I will not turn away its punishment." So basically what this says is for three major crimes, and it says that, you know, in our society, we've done the three strikes and you're out rule. So if you have three major crimes, no ifs, ands, and buts about it, you're going to prison. Now, I'm not sure that that is the pattern we're following, but at one point, not too long ago, that was what the approach we adopted in order to try to deal with the crime problem. But I'm not sure that that continues, but it was the case at one time. So in essence, God was saying three strikes, you get three strikes, but the fourth one, there will be a punishment. You can count on it. God says, I'll give you three flagrant transgressions, but the fourth, the sinful trend, is over. It's going to stop because I'm going to intervene and punish you. Just an explanation from a commentary that I think is helpful. And this is from the Bible Knowledge Commentary. And in a comment on chapter 1, verse 3, it says, "The general declaration of irrevocable judgment occurs through the repeated phrase, for three sins of, even for four, I will not turn back my wrath. And the use of a number followed by the next higher number is frequent in the Old Testament. It's a common way of expressing things. And usually the higher number is enumerated in detail with special emphasis given to the final item. Here, Amos cited only the last of the crimes, the one which had finally gone beyond God's patience. And basically, God is going to inflict punishment at that time. So all of these nations that are mentioned here, Damascus, Ammon, Moab, the Philistines, all of these nations are all going to be punished. They've all done things that are abominable to God, and God is going to inflict his punishment on them. And included in that number are Israel and Judah. Now, Judah, God does not spend much time on. He has a couple of verses that talk about Judah and the punishment that would come their way. But God's main focus is on Israel. And that only makes sense because to whom was Amos sent as a prophet? He was sent specifically to the nation of Israel. So this prophetic formula indicates that, okay, you've gone far enough. I'm going to inflict serious punishment on you. So all of these nations that are cited, God is going to punish them. Let's go to look at Amos chapter 2, verse 6. Amos chapter 2, verse 6. And so why is God going to inflict this punishment? Why is he going to do that? And this is in relation to Israel. It says in verse 6, because Amos 2, verse 6, because they sell the righteous for silver and the poor for a pair of sandals. They pant after the dust of the earth, which is on the head of the poor. And just think about it. They're so covetous. They're so greedy that they even want the dust off of some poor person's head. Can't imagine that, but that's how serious their condition was. It says, and pervert the way of the humble. A man and his father go into the same girl to defile my holy name. They lie down by every altar on clothes taken and pledge and drink wine of the condemned in the house of their God. So, and we see here God is condemning Israel. And after discussing these sins, God then goes to lay out how totally disgusted he is with the nation of Israel. And it shouldn't be a surprise, because as you think of nations that have prospered, every nation that has greatly prospered, they have eventually succumbed to their vices. Sin becomes more and more pervasive in their society, and eventually they fall. You look at Assyria, the Babylonians, the Persians, all of them eventually succumbed to sin. They were prosperous. They prospered for a time. They were dominant for a time, but eventually their prosperity did them in. And this is the very thing that happened with Israel. God said, when you prosper, never forget me. Realize where your prosperity came from and always walk humbly before me and be thankful. Be humble in the way that you live and in the way you treat each other. But that's not the way human beings go. Once they begin to prosper, many times they lose sight of their humanity, and it's very easy for them to oppress their neighbor. For which God was condemning Israel were perversions of justice. They were not victimless crimes. Their justice should have been exercised, which is a good thing, but they did not exercise justice, and they mistreated their neighbor, found ways to take advantage of him. And the victims are always the person who cannot defend themselves. So who are those people basically in most societies? They're widows, they're orphans, they're people that have no power, no money. consider what's happened with our government. Our government has become basically has militarized the wheels of justice and the courts of law, where you're not going to get a sound decision, a righteous decision. You just don't know what you're going to get when you go into court. And unfortunately, if the government, you say something that the government does not agree with, then you can very easily pay the price. You can be in the jail, and it may be very hard for you to get out. So sadly, you know, you look at the poor are taken advantage of, the poor are oppressed. It may be legal, but it's wrong. In God's sight, it's wrong. So these people were well-to-do. They wanted what they wanted, and they were going to do whatever they had to do to get it. So basically, the country had become twisted in their thinking, and unfortunately, God took note of it, and there came a point when God said, okay, I've tried to correct you, but you're not listening, so sterner punishment is coming. So let's go to Amos chapters 3, verse 9, and we'll look at some areas that are laid out there that help us to understand the key issues that Amos is addressing. I'd like to begin this part of the study by reading from Barnes Notes. And Barnes Notes is a good solid commentary, and he talks about the problems in ancient Israel. And he said, it is clear from the statement that we may buy the poor for silver and the needy for a pair of shoes that the prophet is not speaking of judicial iniquity. These aren't crimes by judges. These are crimes inflicted by people on other people. He's talking about the actual buying and selling. The law allowed a Hebrew who was poor to sell himself and a Hebrew to buy them until the year of release. So he could sell himself, but and the person who bought him would treat him as a servant. He wasn't a slave. He was a servant. And he could be a servant and until the year of release, when he could be released from that servitude. But it was not like the bondage of Israel. It was a lighter bondage. You were a servant, serving in a household, serving in whichever way that the master wanted you to serve in order to pay off your debt. So the purchaser of the individual who was in debt was forbidden to serve himself with him as with the service of a slave, but he was like a hired servant. So the laws of God were designed as so that if a Hebrew man sold himself to you, he was to be treated as a servant. He had the right to come and go, and he was not a slave where he couldn't leave the property. He was to be treated with dignity and respect as you would a servant. And it was not to be oppressive. But unfortunately, that's not the way it went. So what happened is these laws were put into effect, and eventually people lost sight of the limits that God put on them. It says of the law gave no power to sell an insolvent debtor. This was not a right. It grew up in practice, and the sons and daughters of the debtor or his wife and children, even the sons of a deceased debtor, were sold eventually in Israel. God never wanted this, never expected this, but this became the practice in the nation of Israel. Going on, it seems to be this merciless selling by the creditor, which Amos rebukes. The righteous is probably the one who, without any blame, became insolvent. I mean, if you, in good faith, purchase seeds and other things to plant in your fields, and the weather goes wrong, and you get very little crop, how can you repay your debt? You can't. And these kinds of things just happen. You know, who can predict some of the things that happen with the weather or with insects that can wipe you out? And so once your crop was gone, you had no means of making money and repaying your debt. And so it's not something you did wrong. It's just time and circumstance that has worked out this way. The pair of shoes that is the sandals expresses the trivial price or the luxury for which he was sold. So you're going to take somebody's shoes that he's maybe walking around Judea or Israel in, you know, they're going to be dirty. They're going to be dusty. That's just the way it's going to be there. And do you want those shoes? Sorry, most people wouldn't. But to illustrate the level of greed, they did want them. You owe me. You got to pay me, and I expect payment. So these people whom God had created, they were being mistreated, and unfortunately, it had become the standard procedure in Israel. Let's look at Amos 3, verses 1 and 2. Amos 3, verses 1 and 2. And these verses tell us where God intends to go. Amos 3, verses 1 and 2. There it says, "Hear this word that the Lord has spoken against you, O children of Israel, against the whole family, which I brought up from the land of Egypt, saying, you only have I known of all the families of the earth. Therefore, I will punish you for all your iniquities." And basically what he's saying is, I called you out. You were my chosen people, and I expected you to act according to my instruction. Don't act like the Egyptians. You know, you hated being in bondage. And so you're going to impose bondage on your neighbor, be exacting with your neighbor. Have you forgotten what you went through in Egypt? But how quickly they forgot. Amos chapter 3, verse 15 gives us a window into the state of extravagance that the wealthy in Israel had been able to enjoy. Amos 3:15 says, "I will destroy the winter house along with the summer house. The houses of ivory shall perish, and the great houses shall have an end." So as you look at these people, they had a summer house probably down in the lower elevation areas of Israel, and you had the higher elevations for the summer, the lower elevations for the winter, and their houses were huge. If you look at houses in the 1950s after World War II, the average size house was 900 square feet. 900 square feet. And I've lived in some of those 900 square foot houses. They're not very big. They're not very big, but you could live in them, and they were clean, and you could keep them clean, and they provided a place to reside and get in and out of the rain and whatever inclement weather there was. And it wasn't bad living. And in the 1950s, we began to prosper. And so in today, since we've moved to Houston, it's been interesting. I mean, there's been a huge amount of growth. Home after home is built. And as we look around, I mean, we bought a house and it's about 2,000 square feet, which is twice as big as the houses in the 50s. And it's plenty of room for Liz and I. But as you look at the other houses that are being built around us, they're huge, huge homes. And if you can afford that and want to live in a huge home, that's fine. That's not a problem. But it is interesting the size of the homes that are being built, and people are buying them and moving into them. And, they're quite ostentatious. And some of them, I know that we met this person who sells bathroom hardware, and it's all upscale bathroom hardware. I didn't know what upscale bathroom hardware is. I mean, if you were using the outhouse back when you were a child or back in the whatever era you came out of, you know, like there was somebody saying that, you know, to be able to use the catalog from Sears was a pretty nice deal. But things are much more luxurious than that. It's amazing. And it talks about ivory houses. And we're not talking about houses that were built from ivory, but we're talking about ivory that was used as for vessels, for ornaments, and for inlaying and decoration in these homes. So ivory is expensive. It was expensive then, it is now, but it could be used to enhance your home and to improve its appearance. And this was something that was very common. If you look at how it describes King Ahab, it says in 1 Kings that he lived in a house of ivory. And as you look at Ahab was of the very mindset of not having any concern for his neighbor. You see that in the book itself when he wants his neighbor's property and he basically begins to pout because his neighbor won't sell it to him. And his wife says, "What are you talking about here? Hey, Ahab, I'll take care of it. I'll just take him out." And she did and gave the property to Ahab. And that's the sad situation that Israel was moving toward in Ahab's time. Let's see, in Amos chapter 4, it's interesting how it begins. It begins in a way that is not politically correct. I don't think any of us would say this, but Amos said this, and there was a reason why he said it, not just to be disrespectful, but he recognized the attitude and the mindset of the people he's talking about. Amos chapter 4, verse 1 says, "Hear this word, you cows of Bashan." So he's speaking about women, and he alludes to them as being like these fat, very cows that are well taken care of. And basically, for cows, they lived quite well. And he's applying this to these women who lived in Samaria, on the mountain of Samaria, who oppressed the poor, who crushed the needy, who say to your husbands, "Bring wine, let us drink." And the mindset of these ladies was something like Marie Antoinette. You may be familiar with her. And Marie Antoinette was the queen of Louis the 16th. And there was a disturbance in the street. The disturbance was quashed by the soldiers. And then she wanted to know, well, what's the problem here? And they said, "The people are starving." And she, based on her experience, had no clue what they were talking about. She had all the food she would ever want. She had variety. She had it in abundance. And from her perspective, what are you talking about? There's plenty of food. But she didn't realize that the poorer people didn't have food. So what did she say? She said, let them eat cake. Because she thought, everybody has cake, just eat the cake. But that's not the way it was, and she just was not in touch with the people and the things that they were going through. So she was very prosperous. And these people that are being described here by Amos, these ladies were very, very rich, very well-to-do. They had power. Their husbands had power and influence in the society. And basically, their approach was, if I need something and I have to crush the needy, then I'll be more than happy to do that. I'm willing to do it because I want to live luxuriously. And I'm willing to do whatever I have to do in order to live luxuriously and to maintain that high standard of living. And unfortunately, instead of saying, well, maybe my neighbor is in need and I should help them, that wasn't the mindset. That's where they had become calloused, where the love of many had waxed cold. And this is the challenge that we face in our society today, where people are so prosperous, they don't stop and think about others. And there are people that do. And we can be thankful that that mindset is not prevalent yet. Let's go to Amos chapter 5, verse 7, and see another issue. Amos chapter 5, verse 7. It's so when you have one of the blessings that we've had as a nation is the rule of law. So the rule of law means that the law is supreme. And if you are not in harmony with the law, then you have to bring whatever it is into harmony with the law. So the law applies to you, to me, to everyone. That's the way the law is to be applied. But unfortunately, judges who are to make the decisions about the law can become corrupted. They can be bought off, and therefore they no longer make good decisions. And we see this in verse 7. It says, "You who turn justice to wormwood and lay righteousness to rest in the earth." And basically, there's a miscarriage of justice. And where justice should be sweet, wormwood is bitter. Justice should be something that is sweet, because what is right is being done. That's the decision that is being applied, the right of path, and everybody benefits from it. But when justice becomes one wormwood, it's something that's bitter. And basically, they were burying the truth, burying that which was righteous, just covering it up, getting it out of the way, and doing what they wanted. So you have all of these terrible injustices taking place in the land of Israel. So as you think about these things that are going on, and I believe you get the gist of it, but the next verse I'm going to cite gives us the antidote for this wrong behavior and this mistreatment of one's neighbor. In Amos chapter 5, verse 14. Amos chapter 5, verse 14. What does it say? It says, "Seek good and not evil, that you may live. So the Lord God of hosts will be with you, as you have spoken. Hate evil, love good, establish justice in the gate. It may be that the Lord God of hosts will be gracious to the remnant of Joseph." So look, you guys are in a very serious condition. And I, as the God, have looked at your condition, and I've tried to correct you. You've not paid any attention to the correction. I've punished you. You've not changed at all. And I really have no choice but to go forward and bring about the punishment that you deserve. But he also tells them that there is a way out. Seek good and not evil. And he gives us the remedy for the problem in the nation of Israel. And unfortunately, that was the prescription to take care of the problem, but it's not something that they took heed of. They didn't listen. They hadn't been corrected by God, and they hadn't listened before, and they certainly weren't going to listen to Amos, it appears, unfortunately. So, unfortunately, as you look at the condition of Israel, they were in a very bad plight. Let's just look at a couple of more verses here. Amos 8, verse 4. Amos 8, verse 4. And it gives us an indication of the attitude and mindset in Israel at the time. Verse 4, it says, "Hear this, you who swallow up the needy and make the poor of the land fail." So they just swallow them up. They make the poor of the land fail. And what's their attitude? What's their approach? Verse 5, saying, "When will the new moon be passed that we may sell grain?" So they were interested in making money. And when will this time of religious celebration come to an end so we can get back to making money? "And the Sabbath, that we may trade wheat." The Sabbath is an impediment. It's not a blessing. it basically just causes me to slow down and be unable to go to work and make money that I want to make to continue my rich lifestyle. And what were they doing? They were anxious to get about trading. And it says later here in the verse, making the ephah small and the shekel large, falsifying the scales of deceit, that we may buy the poor for silver and the needy for a pair of sandals, even sell the bad wheat. So they're wanting to, you know, they're putting the hand on the scale. They're selling people. If it's supposed to be a ephah, it's not an ephah. So they're using the scales to their own advantage to take advantage of other people. So you put your thumb on the scale, so it appears to be a little bit heavier, and you make more money. And they had no qualms about doing this. At the end, so this brings us to the end of the chapter, Amos chapter 9, verse 8. And God notices all this, and he said, behold, the eyes of the Lord God are on the sinful kingdom, and I will destroy it from the face of the earth. Yet I will not utterly destroy the house of Jacob. So you're going to be punished, but I am not going to destroy you completely. You're going to be punished, but I'm not going to destroy you completely. So God, in essence, in this book, says that he is going to punish Israel because, in a sense, their sin is sinfulness is full, and he wants them to obey, but they're unwilling to do so. He tells them that I will only tolerate your disobedience for so long. So there is coming a day of reckoning. And the third part of this is captivity in its worst form is the consequence of ignoring the Almighty God. And that's not just something that took place in ancient Israel. As I said, there's a type and there's an anti-type. This did happen to Israel. They were taken into captivity. And we, as people living in our time, need to be aware that the same, it's the same God ruling over heaven and earth, the same God's laws that God wants us to keep. They've not changed. And as you look at our society is becoming more debased and moving further from God. And there is a day of reckoning coming. And we have to and one of the things that we have to realize is, well, wait a minute, I'm not doing those things. But you know what? You live here. Now, will it affect us? We can't say. We hope that God allows us to escape or to be able to avoid what's coming, but we also have to realize we live here and we may be impacted by some of the things that unfold. So God makes the promise that he's not going to let Israel perish. They may perish as a nation, but God hasn't forgotten them, and there is a day coming when they will be given the opportunity to understand the bigger picture and the right path and to be able to live it. And God is not going to abandon us. God is not going to allow us to perish. He's going to bring us back from captivity and give us the opportunity to, whatever opportunity we missed out on, God will open that way for us. So as we think on these things, as you look at the prophet Isaiah, was sent to Israel. Israel had become prosperous, but unfortunately, they had been corrupted by all of their prosperity, and they had become greedy. They had become covetous, and they were willing to do whatever they had to do to get what they wanted. And Amos is trying to point them in the right direction. And he said that there is a day of reckoning. And as we live at our particular time, we've been well-to-do. But if you look at the signs of things going on around us, they're telling us that there is a change coming. And the prosperity that we've enjoyed may be coming to an end. And, we've all been prosperous. We all have enjoyed the blessings and comforts of life, but we may have less of them going forward. But the thing is, as we are faithful, as we put into practice the truths we know, then whatever unfolds, however, whichever way it goes, we will be blessed, and God will see us through to the end. So thank you all for your attention this evening. Hopefully you found the study profitable, and so we will take up the subject of the minor prophets. The next one that we will be on the book of Obadiah. It'll be a one study. We'll cover that particular book. So we'll look forward to doing that in the next study that we'll be having. So that'll be after the conference and probably on up into the month of May. So
recording stopped.
So I hope you found it profitable, and please have a nice Thursday and Friday. And thank you for joining us this evening.